In this weekend episode, three segments from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program. First, Barbara Perry, Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, discusses former President Trump's 2024 run and the history of former presidents running for non-consecutive terms. Then, a discussion about food insecurity in the U.S. with Billy Shore, founder and executive chair of the group Share Our Strength. Plus, Zero Emission Transportation Association's Joe Britton discusses the future of electric vehicles and the latest improvements to infrastructure.
In The Hill, a column by you is Donald Trump, the next Grover Cleveland, Teddy Roosevelt, or Millard Fillmore in the wake of his announcement for 2024. Explain what those three former presidents have in common.
Right. Well, I actually got this idea the first time in November of 2020, thinking that if it seemed to be going as expected after the vote came in and that it looked like Joe Biden was going to be the winner, what would Donald Trump do? And it just occurred to me that he seemed like he would be the sort of president who would want to run again. So I went back and remembered that Grover Cleveland was one of the presidents to do this and our only president to have actually been successful in doing it. So we've had seven presidents, starting with Martin Van Buren and coming up to Trump. And the two most famous, I think, in that lot are Grover Cleveland, who was successful in getting two non-consecutive terms. And then the other most famous, I would say, is Teddy Roosevelt, who had served out the term as vice president succeeding to the presidency after the assassination of the president William McKinley in 1901. Then Teddy Roosevelt ran in his own right in 04 and then stepped aside, though he could have run again, but he stepped aside for his protege, William Howard Taft. And he won the presidency, but then there was a split between the two of them, and Teddy Roosevelt became more progressive, and he founded a third party when the Republicans wouldn't nominate him. But all he did was end up splitting the Republican base and handed the presidency in the 1912 election to Democrat Woodrow Wilson, who went on to serve for two terms.
The number you said was seven one-term presidents?
Yes, seven one-term presidents tossed their hats into the ring to try to get a non-consecutive second term.
So what was it about Grover Cleveland's run that was successful?
Well, as a matter of fact, so if you look at the calendar, he ran in 1884, 1888, and 1892. And in each of those, including his losing attempt after his first term to serve two consecutive terms, he won the popular vote three elections running. And he was actually a pretty popular president. We didn't, of course, have polls in those days, but he was quite an honest president who didn't believe in the spoil system and patronage. But there were issues related particularly to the gold standard. I just noticed the other night and around many holidays, network show The Wizard of Oz, and most people know that it's a political allegory. The Yellow Brick Road is about the controversies over whether the gold standard should back our currency or whether silver should. And Grover Cleveland was very much in favor of the gold standard, but there were some in the party who favored silver. And so that sort of split the party, and it allowed Benjamin Harrison, the Republican, to win the electoral vote. And let me see, I've got it right here. He won 233 electoral votes to 168 for Cleveland, denying Cleveland then his second consecutive term.
You mentioned the term split the party there when a former president has tried to regain office. Sometimes they split their own party. Explain the history.
Well, they do. And again, I think this was a little bit of a case of this happening, but it certainly does happen often when a president tries for a non-consecutive second term, because typically he will have been denied, unlike Cleveland, he'll be denied his original party's nomination, and then he'll split off from his original party and go to a new party. So, for example, in the case of Van Buren, that controversy leading up to his what would have been a second run and for a non-consecutive term is oftentimes this a terribly jolting issue for the country. In that case, it was slavery. So a new party developed called the Free Soil Party that was an attempt to ban the spread of slavery into new states. That party ended up being folded into the new Republican Party as it was developed in the 1850s. But often, again, that will happen. First of all, there's some kind of really, really destructive issue that's happening that is already splitting voters and splitting parties. And second, if it splits one of the two major parties at the time, it usually allows the other candidate from a party that's rather united to waltz into the White House.
Do you think we're at a point in this day and age that one of the two major parties could see a major split?
Yes, I do. I thought, for example, at one point in 2016, it might be the case, and maybe even in 2020, that Bernie Sanders and that really progressive wing of the Democratic Party might try to split off and run a third party candidacy. And sometimes it's not even a really major movement, but all you need is somebody like Ralph Nader, who gets enough votes to serve as a spoiler, as he did in 2000 for Al Gore. If but for Ralph Nader siphoning off about 300 to 500 votes in Florida, Al Gore would have won Florida and would have won the Electoral College and defeated George W. Bush. So it doesn't even take a major third party. But I could see that happening. We could see it in the Democratic side, and we could see it. Let's just play out a thought experiment. What if Donald Trump does not win the Republican nomination for 2024, but wants to run, and so he forms a MAGA party? That would probably split the Republican vote and some independents, probably siphoning off enough to allow the Democratic nominee to win in 2024.
This was the piece from The Hill that sparked this conversation. Is Donald Trump the next Grover Cleveland, Teddy Roosevelt, or Millard Fillmore? And Millard Fillmore is a president that we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about on C-SPAN. Can we dig more into Millard Fillmore?
Sure. He was president from 1850 to 1853. Like Teddy Roosevelt, he came to the presidency by the death of the president, Zachary Taylor. And here I sit in Louisville. Zachary Taylor was actually born very near Charlottesville in Orange, Virginia. But like many Virginians, including George Rogers Clark, who founded Louisville, he came over to Kentucky and he settled in Louisville. Zachary Taylor did. Eventually, George Rogers Clark did. And so I'm sitting about 2 miles from the home that Zachary Taylor lived in Louisville. And he is buried in a national cemetery, also about 2 miles from me. So this is also sometimes a typical scenario where a vice president will succeed to the presidency. It happened with John Tyler as well. That was after the death of William Henry Harrison. And then the party doesn't really want that vice president who becomes president to run for president in his own right. Now, that was okay for Teddy Roosevelt. It was okay for Lyndon Johnson. It was okay for Harry Truman. But oftentimes the party turns on that vice president who had succeeded to the presidency. And that's what happened to Millard Fillmore. And so he didn't get the nomination of his Whig party to run for a term in his own right. So he waited 4 years and then he joined what was a new party at that time called called the Native American Party, meaning they were nativists. They were an anti-immigrant party. Waves of immigrants were coming to this country shores, particularly in the 1840s. In fact, I'm mostly of German extraction and most of my family came in that period of upheaval in Europe. And settled in Louisville. My mother grew up in Germantown here in Louisville, Kentucky. But there was an anti-German, anti-Irish movement at that time. And that party became known as the Know-Nothings, perhaps somewhat appropriately. But it comes from they were somewhat secretive as well. And it was sort of a cabal. And so they were told, if you join this party and someone asks you about it, say you know nothing. So Millard Fillmore ran as a Know Nothing. I think that wasn't the best PR name for a party. And it's probably not a great idea to have your political party, if you want to win, to be secret and sort of like a secret fraternity. But in any event, he did not succeed.
Just to pull on that string of vice presidents whose party turned on them, what are some other famous examples of that in presidential history?
Yeah, John Tyler is another. So again, a Virginian, in addition to Ohio, Virginia is known as the mother of presidents, and we have all of them pictured in the Miller Center in our Commons Room. But William Henry Harrison, running with John Tyler, Tippecanoe and Tyler too, people probably remember from their history books in high school. But William Henry Harrison, after only 30 days as president, passed away. It used to be that people said probably from pneumonia, because he gave a very, very long inaugural address out in a cold pouring rain. And in those days, people would say, oh, if you got cold and wet, you would get a cold, maybe pneumonia. I think that's probably not true, though. I'm a doctor of political science, not medicine. But I just did a really interesting program recently for the White House Historical Association on whose board I serve. And we had a scholar who's an expert on William Henry Harrison and how he died. And he's gone back to look at the records and he thinks he died of typhus because of the very poor sewage handling in Washington, D.C., particularly around the White House. So that was an example then of John Tyler not getting the nomination of his party and being very upset about that, by the way. So that happened. Harry Truman had a bit of a run to make for in his own right in 1948 after he had served for most of the term of Franklin Roosevelt, who died in 1945, only a few months into his fourth term. And then it coming up to 52, because Truman was grandfathered into the constitutional amendment, which now limits presidents to two full terms, he could have run again in 52. In fact, he kept his hat in the ring, but he was defeated in the New Hampshire primary, the first one that year in 52, by a Tennessee senator called Estes Kefauver, who then ended up becoming the vice presidential candidate in the ill-fated Stevenson ticket in 1956. So sometimes presidents are not wildly popular if they succeed to the presidency through the death or resignation of the vice president. Gerald Ford was not unpopular, but he lost in a close race, as we know, in 76 to Jimmy Carter after succeeding the resigned Richard Nixon over Watergate.
That was Barbara Perry, Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Next, we'll hear from Billy Shore, founder and executive chair of the group Share Our Strength, about efforts to address hunger and food insecurity in the U.S.
Billy Shore, first of all, your group Share Our Strength, what's its purpose? What's its mission?
Share Our Strength focus is on hunger and poverty in the United States and around the world, but our priority for the last 15 years has been childhood hunger in the United States, which based on everything we understand about it, is a very solvable problem. We have no shortage of food in this country. As we all know, we're going to enjoy its blessings this holiday. We have no shortage of food programs either. So our focus has been on eradicating childhood hunger. We believe we can actually get to the point where we may still have poverty in this country. We may still have food insecurity. We don't have to have childhood hunger.
Help us define the two terms that we'll use in this discussion. You talked about childhood hunger, and the statistics are on food insecurity. Is there a difference between those?
Yeah, it's a great question, Bill, and there is kind of an important difference. Food insecurity is really, I guess it's best to think of it as a socioeconomic measure. It's based on a battery of questions that families are asked about the financial stresses on their family and the degree to which they worry or have anxiety. They may not be able to feed their kids healthy meals. When we think of hunger at Share Our Strength and the No Kid Hungry campaign, we think specifically in the physiological sense. Are children getting the three meals a day that they need to survive? The government has one other measure that they use of food insecurity called very low food security, which is based on questions about whether your kids have actually missed a meal. And fortunately, before the pandemic, that number was driven to the lowest level that it had been in over 50 years. So when I say this is a solvable problem, we've got some pretty good evidence that we can get pretty close to solving this. But our first goal and priority as an organization is to make sure that all kids in this country are getting the three meals a day that they need to thrive.
On the food insecurity data, I mean, you could look at the data image from the Department of Agriculture and see this big pie chart, you know, with a big old green of nearly 90% of the country is food secure. But tell us about the 10% that's not, the numbers who have some level of food insecurity. Has that number gotten worse in the United States?
It certainly got worse during the pandemic. Again, before the pandemic, the numbers were heading in the right direction. Today, we've got about 9 million kids who live in families that are food insecure. And it's probably helpful to think about food insecurity in correlation to poverty. You know, when you ask why kids and families are hungry in this country, again, it's not because of the shortage of food. And I said a moment ago, there's no shortage of food programs either. So we have really effective programs that we've seen make a huge difference over the years. We have a national school lunch program, a school breakfast program, a summer meals program when the schools are closed. And then we have efforts like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which we used to call food stamps, and WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Feeding Programs. This creates a battery of support for families who need these types of food assistance. And they've been very effective in driving down food insecurity. Of course, during the pandemic, this all changed. So many jobs were lost, so many businesses and other enterprises were closed. And, you know, we've seen stories of as many as 40% of all of the families who were in line for food assistance during the pandemic. And you remember some of the images of thousands of cars in line at the San Antonio Food Bank or the Atlanta Food Bank. 40% of those families were seeking food assistance for the first time ever. So you get a sense of how close to the margin people were living at. But, you know, we may not be able to have all the answers to solve poverty or food insecurity. We can solve hunger.
And Billy Shore, I think it's helpful to put a perspective on that 10%, that data that, and you kind of touched on this a moment ago, some nearly 34 million people total in the United States have some level of food insecurity, 8.6 million adults in households with very low food security, 5 million children in food insecure household in which children and adults were food insecure, and over 500,000 children, 0.7% of the nation's children in household in which one or more of the child experienced very low food security. How do we measure that data, Billy Shore?
Yeah, well, we get that data by, you know, doing survey research and census data that asks families these questions. And, you know, I'm glad you pointed out, Bill, the 0.7% of kids who live in families that have, you know, very low food security. As tragic as that is, think about that. That's a manageable number in a country with our resources. And, you know, again and again, we've seen programs that work, you know, during the a year ago in the Biden administration, there was a child tax credit, a refundable child tax credit that gave families support as much as $3,000 or in some cases $3,600 per child. That lifted 4 million kids above the poverty line, the greatest increase in moving kids above the poverty line instead of living in poverty that we'd seen in this country. Tragically, we've let it expire, and hopefully legislators will reenact it. But again, we're so close on some of these issues. And the pandemic taught us things about how to feed families in more effective ways. You know, Congress passed a lot of flexibilities and waivers in the early days of the pandemic that took some of the most burdensome regulations off of the efforts to feed hungry families. And so we learned a tremendous amount. And, you know, fortunately, as you point out, these kind of tools, these surveys exist, the census and the USDA data exist that tells us how many families and how many different types of demographics are dealing with hunger. But to me, what it adds up to is, you know, a very solvable problem.
In addition to the end of the child tax credit, what new needs have arisen post-COVID in the area of food insecurity?
Well, you know, one of the things that in the anti-hunger community, has always been a challenge is feeding kids in the summertime when the schools are closed. So many kids depend on school meals. About 22 million children in this country get free and reduced price lunches, and they're all eligible for breakfast as well. Unfortunately, only 12 million get it because at lunch, kids are already there, and at school, there's some logistical challenges to getting kids there early. And in the summertime, only 3 million kids are getting summer meals. So one of the things that happened during the pandemic, which was so instructive, was we our country scaled up something called a pandemic EBT, which stands for electronic benefits transfer. It's basically like a SNAP or a food stamp benefit. And so it gave families the opportunity to go out and do what we all want to do, which is purchase the meals that we think are right and appropriate and healthiest for our family. And we saw the impact that had. So there were so many things that Congress did during the pandemic, including, again, as it relates to summer meals, letting us feed kids on what's called a non-congregate basis. It used to be that all the kids had to come together in one place to get a summer meal that was reimbursable. During the pandemic, we said, no, we have to take food to where the kids are, take them to their homes, take them to community centers, drop the meals off, let kids and families pick up the meals and take them home. So we found out that these flexibilities, far from being in any way, you know, abused, actually create a much more efficient way of feeding kids and families.
Next, a discussion about the electric vehicle industry.
Next, we're joined by Joe Britton, who's the executive director of the Zero Emissions Transportation Association, talking next for the next half hour about electric vehicles and electric vehicle infrastructure. Tell us about the ZETA, Zero Emission Transportation Association. Who do you represent in the electric vehicle space?
Well, Bill, thanks for having me. So we represent the entire supply chain. So we have manufacturers like Tesla and Rivian, Lucid, Lordstown, but then we have utilities, charging companies, critical mineral developers, and then also the battery manufacturers and recyclers. And our goal, what brings us all together, is trying to attain 100% EV sales by the year 2030. And so the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which you talked about last half hour, and then the Inflation Reduction Act are all going to do an enormous amount towards accelerating that transition.
So your association is, you mentioned, celebrating its two-year anniversary here. How is it going in terms of, you saw the infrastructure bill pass, obviously, in terms of reception from not only lawmakers, but regulators as well?
Well, we've actually contributed to some of the performance and emission standards work that NHTSA and EPA have done. But congressionally, I think everybody is interested in this space. It's an ascendant sector. But, you know, by and large, it's this new manufacturing corridor. So everybody is seeing job growth. So you have the traditional automotive sector. So let's, you know, say Michigan and Ohio. But if you look further south, you've got Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, the Carolinas. We've got new announcements in Arkansas and Kansas. So you're really spreading out the number of members of Congress that are interested in the space.
Yeah, and some of that, as you pointed out, is not just vehicle manufacturing, it's the battery manufacturing that's part of it. Tell us about some of the newer ones that are opening up across the country.
Well, so LG just announced 2 days ago a $2.3 billion plant in Tennessee. Tennessee, the governor's done a really great job recruiting in and seeing manufacturing growth. Governor Bill Lee actually said that these investments are some of the biggest economic investments in the state's history. You're also seeing announcements in Arkansas and Kansas. Like I mentioned, Panasonic had a big announcement in Kansas. But these are billions of dollars and thousands of jobs, and, you know, obviously everybody wants to be a part of that.
Yeah, I drive down 85 every now and then in Georgia, and near Commerce, there's a huge battery plant down there. It must be like a million plus square feet.
Yeah, I visited the Tesla Gigafactory in Austin, and it was stunning how much work is being done there and just the sheer size of the effort.
So is this being driven by President Biden's announcement last year of the 50% EVs by what is it, 2030?
Well, I think the Biden administration has really leaned in, and they deserve a lot of credit. I also think the market itself is driving this. So you've got the manufacturers that are now newly committing to go fully electric. And I think there's, you know, some ascendant pressure that the full pure play EV companies, the ones that we represent, are applying because they're taking on the incumbents and doing things in more innovative and efficient ways. And so there's a race going on. And it's not just in the U.S. There's a global race to win the clean transportation sector, because we obviously want to be, reshoring our supply chains, having the innovation and manufacturing done here instead of being behind the curve and importing that. And we don't have to actually look very far back to see what happened when you fall behind. So if you look in the 2005-2006 range, you had gas price spikes, and all of a sudden Americans decided that more fuel efficient foreign imports were better. And so that's what in part led to the big three auto bailout. And so we want to get ahead of this.
Tell us about your observations about the public demand for EVs. And is that driven, has that been driven more by the gas price surge in the last 9 months or so?
Well, I think it certainly helped. We actually did a study, so we compared the AAA gas prices to the Energy Information Agency electricity pricing, and in most states, it's about 4 to 6 times more expensive to drive a gas-powered car, and obviously as gas prices spiked, that generated more pocketbook interest for folks to go electric. But I think the other thing that's really, to me, what is really going to be driving growth in the sector is new vehicles that look and feel like the kind of vehicles that Americans expect when they're going to work or to soccer practice, and so you're seeing the actual sector diversify and offering more vehicles. And so I think that's going to drive a ton of new interest.
Are those vehicles performing the way that people want them to? Are they, you know, we see electric trucks, we see the Ford F-150, their version of the electric version of that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I drive a Rivian R1T pickup. I absolutely love it. And as you know, the power in each of these EVs, the torque and performance is just phenomenal, I think. So if you take the gas savings, you take the performance of the vehicles, and then they're just innovative products, right? So it's just a superior product. And I think people that experience them, what we've seen is that 95% of the time, they never go back to an internal combustion engine vehicle. And so as you can imagine, the product is selling itself.
Address the concerns that people would have about buying an electric vehicle, especially on a weekend like this, where you're going, maybe you're traveling 300 miles, and How often do you have to recharge? Are there enough recharging stations across the country to accommodate all of the travelers who will be out, many of whom will be traveling this weekend?
So I've actually done it a couple times. I've driven from Nebraska and D.C. and back. I actually flew to Normal, Illinois to pick up my pickup and drove it back to D.C. Really what people, I think, you know, it's kind of a mentality shift. So we're used to, you know, driving to an empty, stopping for 5 minutes, filling up and moving on. This is actually a little different in that you're going to be charging when you stop. And so, you know, for the normal EV, you could probably drive 4 or 5 hours without stopping, but you actually are the impediment, not the vehicle. You want to stop and eat, use the restroom and, you know, stretch your legs. And so if you stop where there's charging, you never really are impeded in your trip. So it's really a matter of just, you know, taking that mentality. You're going to be charging from 30% to 60%. You're eating lunch. You're going from 50 to 90. It's really not that 0 to 100 that you experience with a gas-powered vehicle.
Is there any data from your organization or elsewhere on the typical charging time on these long-distance trips like this?
Well, I don't have the hard data, but anecdotally, and this is something that I've experienced, you're really charging for 10 or 15 minutes. You're stopping, you're grabbing a bite to eat, you're stretching your legs, and you're moving on. And obviously, if you're going to be, you know, somewhere eating lunch for an hour, you've got plenty of charging. That can be a level 2 charger, adding plenty of mileage and range.
That was Joe Britton, Executive Director of the Zero Emission Transportation Association, which represents the electric vehicle industry. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.